Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Thursday, January 17th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a fun show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy from The Athletic, CJ Moore, and we went into everything going on with the Duke program right now. Trey Jones' injury, the matchup with Virginia on Saturday. Should Zion Williamson actually quit this team? What is going on with Cam Reddish and his inconsistency? Then we go into CJ's bread and butter, the Big 12. How has Kansas looked without Udoka Azubuike? Is Kansas State back? Is Iowa State the best team in the conference? Is Texas Tech actually the best team in the conference? What does TCU look like without Jalen Fisher? Before I get into all of that, I have to make the usual ask. Please rate. Please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. Any interactions that you have with this episode, whether you download it, whether you rate it, whether you review it, whether you subscribe to the podcast itself, it really does help. It helps us in the metrics. It helps us in the rankings. It makes my bosses happy. When my bosses are happy, I'm happy. When I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So giving me 5 stars and saying nice things about me is really only going to help your life in the long run. So I thank you for anything you can do. And now let me get into that conversation with CJ Moore. And now I'm thrilled to welcome back onto the podcast from The Athletic, one Mr. CJ Moore. CJ, what's going on, my man? How you doing?
Rob, doing well. What's going on, brother?
Not too much, man. Not too much. I want you to tell me, so a couple weeks back, you worked for The Athletic, and you guys always have these Q&As on the website, and I asked you a question on one of them that apparently I thought was obvious that was not a serious question, and you answered it like it was a real serious question, and I got a text like 2 days later being like, was that you that asked that question? So tell me what happened there.
Yeah, see, you know, I'm just firing away on those things. Like, it's a little nerve-wracking because there's just a lot of questions coming at you, you know, in a short period of time, and I almost prefer to do the mailbag because – I like to marinate on stuff a little bit, and you know, so they're all firing at me. I see this one, I'm like, man, who's talking crap on my game? Blah blah blah, whatever. Just shoot it out. And then like a day later, Jesse Newell, who writes for Kansas City Star, I see him, and he's like, I was gonna clown you on your chat, but then I saw Rob did it, so I didn't need to. I was like, wait, what are you talking about? He's like, Rob, yes. I was like, oh shoot, that was him. I didn't even know. I didn't even like look at the name and realize Rob D obviously is Rob Doster. So yeah, you got that one past me, and I probably sounded like I don't even remember what I said.
I think it was something
about my assist turnover rate was four.
I said
which is obviously not the case. Big assist guy, low turnover guy. Come on, you know that.
Yeah, you are a good passer. Your shooting is where you kind of run into a little bit of an issue.
Hey, I played yesterday over at Kemper for like the first time in probably 6 weeks since my league finished, and I thought I was going to be awful. I shot the heck out of it. I played 5 games. I probably made 1 or 2 threes every game, and I maybe missed like 3. The whole time. So I was shooting it. You were sending these rumors out here that I can't shoot. I will admit I'm a streaky shooter, but it's there occasionally.
I'm jealous that you're still playing, man. I probably haven't played in like seriously played in like a year, maybe a little bit more.
Gotta make a comeback.
I think I'm officially retired at this point.
I hold on to like once a week with the league, but I this noontime game at Kemper is going to become a regular thing. So I gotta at least get away once a week and do that. That's noon ball. Like, there's nothing more. That's been my dream forever, is like to find a good noon ball game, because at night it's hard, right? It's hard to break away from your family. You got going to games a couple times a week. So noon ball is like the dream. I think this could be legit. Jeff Hawkins, former Jayhawk Jeff Hawkins, was playing. It was a good time. So yeah, you got to find you a good noon ball game.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's the answer. The problem with me is like the gym that I go to, where I would go to play, is like it's like a smaller court. You know how sometimes there's those gyms where the out of bounds line like intersects the 3-point line about the foul line.
Yeah, that's not about your game.
No, it's not about my game, and it's a little bit small, and it's one of those gyms where
You don't have to run as far. That might be good for you.
No, no, it's good. Like, I would literally only have to move 10 feet from one three-point line to the other. But the problem with it is, like, people go in there and they wear their outdoor shoes on the basketball court. They don't have some requirement where you got to have gamers on. And it's just the court is so slippery, and I'm out there and I'm running around, and I feel like I'm going to end up, like, blowing an Achilles out. And it's not worth it for a court that isn't fun. And I don't know anybody there. And it's just not for me. The run's actually pretty good. It's not bad.
Yeah. But knowing people is key. I'm glad I still, my crew's like, most of them are like a few years younger than me. We've got Jarrett Sutton, who's like in his mid-20s that was a walk-on at Mizzou. So I'm hoping I can at least always find like a younger group that continues to play, so I can be that old guy on the team.
Yeah. That's what I had going with the when I was back in D.C., the men's league team that we had. We were actually real good, man. Like, we had a couple low D1 guys, and then an NAIA guy that was all conference, and a D3 guy that was all league for like a top 10 team. No, it wasn't me. I was a shooter. Like, I was one of the worst players on the team. I just kind of stood around and shot threes because they were all like 25, 26, 27 years old. And I'm out here like 32, 33, just firing up jumpers. It was great though. Like, literally all I had to do was stand outside the 3-point line and wait for one of them to do something athletic and then catch and shoot.
Know your role.
I know my role. I'll tell you that much. Speaking of knowing their role, we need to talk before we get, I have you on here. Obviously you cover Kansas and Kansas State, you know, the Big 12 as well as anybody that does this, but we do need to talk about Trey Jones, and we need to talk about Duke because of his injury. And I know I have some takes on this, but just real quick, like, what do you think is Duke's ceiling without Trey Jones? Like, assuming this thing, I know Dana has her, the quotes from Coach K saying he doesn't think this is a long-term injury. But what do you think? Can they win a title? Like, let's say he never comes back and gets back to what he was. Can they win a title without Trey Jones being full Trey Jones?
I don't know that can, because I still don't know if they have enough dudes. Like, I think you would have to move R.J. Barrett probably to point guard and get him to kind of facilitate a little bit. I mean, they probably could, because, I mean, they do have three really good dudes. But, like, just it's really a depth issue at that point too. And I don't know if their bench is good enough to and then the shooting is obviously an issue. Like, this team needs easy baskets and needs to be able to get out and transition. And that, like, you look, go back to that Texas Tech game. Like, they could not score in the half court, and they don't win that game without Trey Jones, because he got a bunch of steals and was able to get some live ball turnovers, and they're excellent in transition. But, you know, if you can slow them down into a half-court game, you know, for instance, I didn't watch the Syracuse game, but obviously they probably slowed them down, made them play against the zone, and they don't shoot it that great. So I think it's going to be really, really tough to win six straight games when you kind of have those holes.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. And so here's the thing about Trey Jones. There's two reasons in my mind that he's not the best freshman. I think you could probably make the argument that he is the fourth best freshman that they have on that team. But he is the most valuable piece, and maybe the most indispensable piece, because of what he provides and how he brings everything together. There's two reasons for this. One is on the offensive end. He makes R.J. Barrett play off the ball. And I know that R.J., he gets these assists, and he kind of has this reputation for being a playmaker, and I think he wants to be a lead guard, eventually maybe a one, but that's not what he does best. What he does best is attack to score. That is what he's wired to do. That's how he's built. That's his mindset. That's what his skill set gives him. That's what he is best at doing. And when when Trey Jones is on the floor, it means that RJ plays off the ball, and he can just go out there and attack. And he doesn't have to worry about facilitating. He doesn't have to worry about setting people up. He doesn't have to worry about initiating an offense. He doesn't have to worry about anything other than getting the ball, going to the rim, trying to make a play. And that's what he's best at. And so Trey Jones' presence lets him do that. The other part of it, though, is you kind of touched on this. The dirty little secret about Duke is that they're not a very good half-court offensive team. They can't really shoot the ball. Outside of RJ and Cam, they don't really have anybody that is that serious of a threat in the half-court. Like, I know Zion is great, but Zion is limited offensively in a way where he's not somebody that you just give the ball to and expect him to go make a play. right? Like he can do some of those things, but part of the reason that he's hidden a little bit offensively, part of the reason why RJ Barrett has taken like what, 150 more shots than he has, is because he has some of these flaws and some chinks in the armor on the offensive end of the floor. So Cam Reddish and RJ are the two guys that can go out and make a play, but with Reddish playing the way that he's playing, bottom line, they're just not great on that end, which is why they get so many points in transition, which is why they're so reliant on the transition. And what Trey Jones does, not just with like the on-ball pressure, everybody sees those like pick six turnovers he has, right? When he picks the point guard's pocket and goes in and gets a layup at the other end of the floor. That helps. But the other part of it is like when he's on the court, it takes 8-9 seconds to get the ball over half court. When you get the ball over half court, you're generally speaking going to have your back to the basket trying to initiate offense 40 feet away from the rim. By the time you finally get into your set and get into your offense and make that first pass and have the action started, there's what, like 10, 12, 14 seconds left on the shot clock. Then you kind of have to run through your offense, and before you know it, you're in a late clock scenario. Then you got to force up a jumper. Then you got to, you know, try to get an isolation. You're going to get a lower efficiency shot. And when you get that lower efficiency shot, you're more likely to miss, which means all of a sudden you got Zion Williamson getting a defensive rebound and going in transition. You have RJ Barrett getting a defensive rebound and going in transition. So it's not just the turnovers that Trey Jones forces that allows him to get out in transition. It's the missed shots that lead to 3-on-2 or 2-on-1 breaks or runouts or just Zion Williamson being able to attack a defense in transition without getting set. That's the totality of it. Is what makes Trey Jones so important to this Duke team and so valuable to this Duke team. And it's the reason why I do not think they can win a title without him. Maybe if they can kind of like switch some things around, like what I'm curious to see, let's say he doesn't play against Virginia. I'm curious to see if they'll put Cam Reddish in a point guard spot. Like that's kind of what he was coming up, right? If you put Cam Reddish at the one and you let RJ kind of play off the ball, then all of a sudden you're in a situation where you have RJ in his best position. You maybe have Cam a little bit more engaged than he hasn't been in the past. And you could put somebody like, I don't know, Alex O'Connell on the floor to help create a little bit of floor spacing, or Jack White on the floor to help create a little bit of floor spacing, even though he was 0-for-10 from beyond the arc against Syracuse. So that's kind of where I am with this whole Trey Jones conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I got some fun trivia for you.
Hit me.
Based off kind of what we're talking about here. Where do you think Duke ranks in overall half-court efficiency?
And are you looking at synergy?
Yeah, yeah. You might know this off the top of your head because maybe you've been looking at it.
No, already. I actually haven't looked it up. I was just going off of anecdotally. What are they, like 60th percent, something like that?
No. Just where did I've pulled up where they actually rank.
Yeah. What is it?
96
out of 300 and
350 whatever there are now. It's 353.
Yeah. So I mean that's good. And it's not great.
It's good. It's not great. Where do you think, you know, who they play this week in Virginia? Probably going to be a slow game, right? Where do you think Virginia ranks?
Number one, number two,
six.
Six. Yep. That makes sense.
And then, okay. Where do you think Duke, you know, to speak to the, how much, you know, obviously he's important in their transition game because his defense gets them out in transition, right? We already talked about this. Where do you think they rank in the number of transition points they've scored this year?
I'm going to go with first. It's got to be first.
They're eighth.
Top 10. There you go.
Top 10. I mean, it's really, really high. You're going to have like some pretty weird teams up there. Number one. I didn't look who was number one, but it's probably somebody goofy. So, yeah, really, really elite transition team. Score a ton out in transition. But Florida International, for those wondering, are number one. Buffalo, number two.
Yeah,
Gonzaga, number three.
Zags make sense, too.
Central Michigan 4, Savannah State 5, which makes sense because they play like super, super fast, shoot a ton of threes, Citadel, and then Georgia Southern, then Duke. Then North Carolina right behind them.
Oh, look so, at that.
Anyway, kind of some interesting numbers, I thought, that speak to how important Trey Jones is. Because, hey, if they're 96th with him, what are they going to be without him?
Yeah. You know, and actually, you know, it makes sense then to maybe give Cam a little bit of run at the point in the half court. I would love to see that actually, just because I think that's kind of where his value is from an NBA draft and pro potential perspective, is that you have a guy 6'8", 7'1" wingspan, tools defensively, can make threes, but oh, he also is somebody that can work a ball screen a little bit and can beat people off the dribble and attack a closeout and is a little bit more skilled with the ball than I think he's been able to show so far this season. That's part of the reason why I think without Trey Jones, my money is on Virginia going into Cameron Indoor and winning that game.
For sure.
Yeah, I think the way that – I know you didn't watch the Syracuse game, but basically what they did by about like the midway point in the second half was they just completely stopped guarding the three-point line. They they more or less had like all five bodies within about 12 feet from the rim, and they just dared R.J. Barrett to shoot, and he shot 17 threes and missed 13 of them. They dared Jack White to shoot, and he shot 10 threes and missed all 10 of them. It got to the point where they weren't even – they weren't even stepping outside the lane to pretend like they were going to go challenge a shot. You know how, I mean, you're a pickup basketball player. You know how when you have a guy that's missed a couple threes and you start when he has the ball in three, you just don't go out there and you just yell at him something like, yeah, that's the shot we want. That's the shot we want. Give him that. Let him have that. That's basically
what he's missing that 9 times out of 10 too.
Yes. And you get in his head and he starts thinking about it and it's a confidence thing. And that's exactly what happened with Jack White. Jim Boeheim was just like, that's the shot we want. So
there you go.
Yeah, that's what I think is going to end up happening with Virginia, because their entire defense, I mean, you know this about the pack line. They pack it inside. They don't let you drive. They don't let you get offensive rebounds, and they force you to make jumpers over the top of the defense. And mm-hmm. I know that Duke is not going to be able to do that. So I think that Virginia is going to end up winning that game. I wonder, I don't know how much you do like with spreads and anything, but what do you think the line's going to end up being in that game?
Oh, man. I mean, honestly, Virginia should be favored. Let's see. KenPom has it at –
they have it 71-69 Duke. So Duke favored by two. But that doesn't factor in Trey Jones.
I bet it's like a maybe Duke minus like a half a point or 1.5.
See, I would guess that if Duke is – or Virginia is getting points, then I'm gonna be all over that.
I would bet Virginia.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm probably going to end up, if the over-under ends up being like 140, which is what KenPom is projecting, then I'm going to hammer that under too. Virginia and the under all day in Cameron. That's how I lose my money, CJ.
Yeah, I lose my money by letting my wife have a credit card. But
all right, last thing. Have you been paying attention to this conversation about like Zion Williamson should skip college or anything? Have you been listening to this?
No, I haven't.
So Scottie Pippen went on, I don't know, one of those talk shows in the morning and said that Zion Williamson should not play anymore for Duke. He should sit out the rest of the season because his draft position is locked up. He's going to be the number one pick. He's proven everything that he needs to prove, and there's no sense in him playing for free. Do you have any takes on that?
I mean, does he not like fun? Because it's fun to play college basketball. And at this point, let's say he gets injured, which would really, really suck. But I still think he would go – it wouldn't hurt his draft stock that much. He'd probably still go number one, because I think we're in an age where people realize getting injured is more of a luck thing than like a, oh, this guy might be injury prone. And you know, if he likes fun, then he should probably continue to play college basketball. And playing college basketball and playing in March is only going to help his brand and only probably going to give him a bigger shoe deal.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about Zion is he's reached the point, like he's unlike any prospect that we've seen, and that he doesn't need a bigger brand. Like how much bigger can his brand get?
True. You know? But March can even get even more people aware of you. So I don't know, but yeah, he's going to get a huge shoe deal regardless, but I guess I understand it. I just, to me, like if you're a competitive person and you like having fun, then just keep playing. Like you're pretty much locked up to be a millionaire. Playing isn't going to hurt you. Not playing's not going to hurt you, but might as well just play.
See, the only thing I agree with you. I think that he should play. If I was advising him from a financial standpoint, I think I would, you know, strictly financial, not about like work-life balance, not about you know, how happy his life is and how much fun he is having being a kid in college or being a kid that is not yet in the NBA. I might say don't go and play, because if he sits out, it's two things. What makes Zion unique is that he already has this like massive brand, right? Everybody already knows who he is. He didn't even need to go to college to get a massive shoe deal because of how much hype he had based off of mixtapes and based off of YouTube and based off of Instagram and all of that kind of stuff, right? Based off of the fact that Drake wore his jersey when he was a junior in high school. So he had a big enough brand and a big enough social media following that he was going to get a huge sponsorship deal regardless of what happened. The other part of it is he weighs like 275 or whatever pounds, right? And for me, the issue, like his weight has never been an issue of can he do the things he needs to do on a basketball court with carrying that weight, because like, I mean, just watch him. Obviously, he can. Like, having 275 pounds on his frame isn't an issue for him being able to get the 46 inches in the air when he tries to block a shot. So
it's a longevity thing.
It's a longevity thing. How many times – this was the way that I described it, is imagine going and standing on your kitchen counter and jumping off of your kitchen counter and landing on the kitchen floor and going and doing that like hundreds of times a day, every day for the rest of your life, and think about how your knees would feel when you were doing that. Now imagine that you are 270 or whatever pounds like Zion Williams is, and every time that you go and you jump and you try to block a shot or you try to dunk, you have all that weight landing from that high up on your knees and on your ankles and on your hips. And it just, those joints aren't necessarily designed to be able to handle that much weight falling on top of it over and over and over again. So that's kind of where my concern is with the weight. It's not, can he move the way that he needs to move? It's how long is his body going to hold up? And every single time that he plays a basketball game for free, maybe that is a basketball game at the end of his career that he might lose when he would actually get paid for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but he wouldn't just be sitting on his butt not working out. Yes, so
that's the argument.
Yeah, I mean, he's still, you know, putting mileage on it that way too. So I get where you're coming from. He's almost like, it's almost like a pitcher. You only have so many bullets in the arm.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, I understand the argument, but if I was just like, if that was my son, I would tell him go out and play, go enjoy it. Like, this is going to be fun. Like, you're playing with guys that you're really good friends with. You're never going to experience something like this ever again. Maybe you're not getting paid for it, but you know what? We can take out an insurance policy for X amount of dollars if you want to play out the rest of the way, so that we can be set and we can be fine financially. If, let's say, that you happen to blow up both of your Achilles on the exact same play and you get your right arm amputated at the same time. So
if a gorilla comes onto the court and
if like the Jumbotron happens to land on your left leg and it falls out of the ceiling. So
I am really impressed though, Rob, by this this jumping off the kitchen counter thing. Did that come a while? Take a little while to come up with? Like, this, I like the analogy. That's pretty good.
I was just thinking, like, what's the
equivalent of what he's going through?
Yes. Yeah. Well, just think about like how high he jumps, because literally I measured my kitchen counter. It's like almost 4 feet off the ground. And so like think about that for a second. Like, imagine going and jumping that high every single time that you jump.
Yeah,
really, it's striking, dude. Like, imagine.
You know, it makes me think of so my dad is a truck driver, and I used to go around with him when I was a kid, and you know, the truck is pretty high up, right? And you know, when I was a little kid, I would jump down from there, and my dad's like, "Don't do that! Like, you're killing your knees." So, you know, he's basically doing that all the time.
Every single time that he jumps,
yeah,
Papa Moore would not be happy with Zion Williamson.
Papa was a leaper. He didn't pass that down to me, though.
Yeah, I know. I can tell. I've seen you play. All right, let's get into your bread and butter. Let's talk about the Big 12. You cover Kansas. You know that program as well as just about anybody. They've played, what, 4 games now without Udoka since he went down for the rest of the season?
That sounds right.
3-4 games, something.
It all runs together, Rob. But yeah.
What are they doing differently? How well do you think they're playing without him? What's the learning curve? Talk to me a little bit about Kansas without Udoka.
Well, you know, I think they got a little bit of a head start because he missed that time in December. And but they are, you know, when that happened, it was, okay, he's out, but he's coming back. So we're not going to necessarily change significantly because we know he's returning. And now that he's out, but at the same time, you still have that like Silvio carrot hanging out there that, oh, we might change a little bit when he gets back. But if and when he gets back. But anyway, without Udoka, you know, obviously they're playing small. It makes Dedrick more effective, because at least from a scoring standpoint, because I think Dedrick really has to get some post-up touches and be able to play in deep. He's been better when he's been able to do that. And with Udoka out there, you know, spacing-wise, it just wasn't happening. Like, he barely was posting up at all when Doak was on the floor. I think he posted up something like 15 times all year next to Doak. So, it makes him more effective scorer. I think really what we saw the other night and one thing that we're probably going to figure out over these next couple of weeks is their ceiling offensively might surprisingly have a decent amount to do with Marcus Garrett, because when he's an actual threat, it opens up a lot of things. It makes it actually, LeGerald Vick can get some open shots, which, like, recently he was not getting any open shots. Everybody was no help against him. The scouting report on Kansas was, you don't leave LeGerald, you make him take contested shots. And if he's not getting open shots, he's going to force bad shots. So that was happening some, and that's kind of why their offense was struggling. Everybody was just crowding Dedrick, and he was still getting his, but it was a lot harder. And, when Garrett hit a couple shots the other night, it opened up things for both of those guys. And even if Garrett's not making shots, if he's just a threat driving the ball, because they've needed, Kansas always has that secondary ball handler. Like, when they had Frank, they had Devontae. And so you had two guys going at you all the time that made it really tough to guard them. Well, this year, all they've really had is Devon Dotson. But Garrett, recently, since Udoka's gone out, has been more aggressive driving the ball, and that just makes it so defenses have to pay attention to them. So they're a small ball team that doesn't really shoot it well, but they're kind of figuring out how to score at a decent rate like that. And the Ochai, Egbaji, like, that name is so hard to say, so that's why I just call him Ochai.
It's Ochai, it's not O'Shea.
It's Ochai.
Ochai.
It's Ochai. All right. And he's helped them just because he gives them another guy that can kind of shoot it, but gives them energy, gives them a little more move. Like, I felt like after when the first game he played, everybody was just the movement and the flow was much better. He just kind of gave them that energy. So they're moving better. They're cutting better. There's a little bit more flow into that four small lineup, and that's kind of what they figured out since they've lost Udoka. And then defensively, they really miss his rim protection, but they're starting to get better defensively, kind of figuring out how to play without him. But that's a major hole for them is not having his rim protection, because it's a poor shooting team in the Big 12, or sorry, poor shooting league. And so Udoka, you give up more threes because of his ball screen stuff, but you could kind of live with that this year, and they're going to miss his rim protection.
Yeah, the Marcus Garrett thing is interesting, because that came out of nowhere. I can't ever remember. Like, I watched the game, and who was it? It was who did they play last? I'm blanking. Oh, it was Texas. And he had 13 straight points at one point in the first half, and three of them were threes. And I swear I had never seen –
career high already.
Yeah. Like,
13.
I'd never – was it really? Wow.
He tied his career high when he got to 13, yeah. And that was like in the first 7 minutes or something.
I'd swear I'd never seen him make a three in all of the times that I've watched Kansas play. I cannot remember him hitting one three, and he made three of them in a row.
He was like 4 for 20-something going into that game, I think.
And that's huge for him, because I feel like they need another guy that can get them a bucket on the perimeter. Like, Devon Dotson, as good as he's been, I don't think that you can necessarily put him in the same conversation, at least not yet, as any of the guards that they've had in recent years. Like, I think that he's lightning quick in transition, but I don't think that you want him being basically like your number one driver and penetrator to score in the half court. I just don't think that that's necessarily ideal. So having, like you said, having Garrett or having
he's Quentin going Grimes, to be though he's going to continue to be their number one driver.
I see. That's not. I mean, I guess that's the way it's going to work out, but it doesn't seem like that's necessarily an ideal situation for him. But I guess at this point, like, nothing is necessarily ideal, especially when they're so. Talk to me a little bit about Quentin Grimes. Where is he, and what is the what's the growth pattern on him? Is he getting more confidence? Is that why he's missing shots? Like, give me all of the info on Quentin Grimes.
I actually think he's looked a little bit more confident lately. You go back his last. Okay, so he went 3 of 6 from three against Iowa State, which was kind of came out of nowhere a little bit because he'd been struggling shooting the ball. But since then, he's 3 of 12 from three. I kind of think he's like a 33-ish percent three-point shooter. Like, that's just what he is, you know? And, you know, closer to third. Like, he's just not a great shooter. And then he hasn't shown a lot of confidence in his driving game. Like, when I watch him, he just doesn't look like he's confident in his handle. And that's maybe the thing that surprised me the most. I thought he was going to be a guy that could come in and be that secondary ball handler and, you know, attack guys, get some penetration and pitches and that kind of stuff. And he really hasn't been able to do much of that. He's driven some, but not a lot. You see glimpses of it every once in a while, but he just doesn't look confident enough in his handle to really play that role. So really what he is just kind of a spot-up shooter, occasionally drive guy, and he's just kind of a body out there really right now.
Yeah, a spot-up shooter that is shooting 30% from three is not necessarily the ideal situation for any team. And I kind of think that's probably why you're seeing
Ochai.
You're seeing Ochai get a little bit of bump in minutes. And, man, he's fun. What a great story that kid is.
Yeah, he's super fun. And still no turnovers in three games.
I know nothing about that.
And what's great, like somebody asked me today, okay, why would Quentin Grimes come in and maybe struggle and it's been harder for him, and Ochai comes in and he doesn't look like there's much pressure on him, he's just playing and, you know, he's been able to do that like that. Well, I think the biggest thing is for Quentin is like, okay, there's an expectation that he's going to score, he's going to do all these things. He came in with all this hype, right? So he's got to go out and try to show he can do those things. With Ochai, it was like, okay, just go out there, blend in, don't mess up, give us some energy. He's already probably their second or third best defender. And, you know, take open shots if you have them, but we're not going to give you the ball in like ball screens and ask you to do any of that. Like, you're just a spot up guy cutter, and it's a really easy roll. Move the ball when you get it, throw it to the post occasionally. He's not asked to do a lot except just be an athlete. And he's done really well in that role so far. And they needed that. They just kind of needed another switchable guy, because when you don't have a rim protector, the more switchable, better perimeter defenders you have, the better your defense can get. And so that's why he's, you know, it surprised me. Like, I thought first game he'd get like 5 minutes, you know, and I think he played – what was it? When he played 23?
I think he's played 25 every game, 23, something like that. At least, yeah, 20 in every game.
It was 25 in the first game, then 21 against Baylor and 25 against Texas. And it was fun. I got a cool little moment in my story that night, his first game. I told his mom, I was like, you know, he played 25 minutes, no term. But she's like, that's how many he played? Like, she couldn't believe it. It's like, you'll have to go back and check that at that little line in my story. It's pretty, it was pretty cute. But yeah, just really nice kid, really nice family. It's been pretty cool to see. But I didn't expect him to get this kind of run right away. And he's really helped him.
I think that what he provides, you mentioned it, with kind of like that versatility defensively, it makes them, when they roll out that lineup where they have Gerald Vick and Marcus Garrett and Ochai Igbaji, they all of a sudden have three guys that are all kind of big enough to defend up a little bit. They're all athletic enough to defend on the perimeter. And all of a sudden you have a team that is actually kind of a little bit of a playmaker on the defensive end. And I don't, it would not surprise me to see them get out and try to pressure a little bit more when you have athleticism. That's a hard word for me to say today.
Yeah, try saying Igbaji. No, they really have pressured a little bit more. Now, Texas didn't turn it over at all, but their previous two games before that, TCU turned it over on 27% of their possessions and Baylor 20.4. So they have been able to kind of, you know, force some turnovers with him out there. And they've shown like some 1-2-2, kind of a little trapping three-quarter court defense with him at the top. And they've definitely tried to pressure out a little bit. And, you know, Dotson, that's what he really does well is pressuring opposing point guards. And I do think it'll be a team that needs to turn people over a little bit without that rim protection.
Where do you stand on Kansas State now?
K-State is back, Rob.
They are. They looked – so they were I think
they were dead, Rob.
They were dead. Like I legitimately, it was halftime of the game. No, early in the second half, the game against West Virginia. They had just lost two in a row. They were sitting there at 10-4, and I looked at like the score app on my phone on ESPN, and they were down 42-21 at home to West Virginia. And I swear this is true. I sent a text to a another college basketball writer, and I said, "This is it. This is the year that Bruce Weber gets fired, isn't it?" And from that moment, since I sent that text, they outscored West Virginia and they ended up winning that game by two. Then they went into Ames and they beat Iowa State by one. And then after that, they went into Oklahoma, a team that going into that game was ranked outside the top 200 in offensive efficiency, according to KenPom, put up 74 points on a team that was top 10 in defensive efficiency in their own building and won by 13 in a game that wasn't even really that close in the second half. Most of the second half, they were down by like 18, 20 points. So what's going on with Kansas State? Is this just Dean Wade getting back? Are they just starting to figure it out offensively? Is it Barry Brown mid-range jumpers that are changing this thing? Like, what the hell is going on in Manhattan?
Well, they're so much better one when Barry Brown makes shots. But I think a lot of it is just having Dean Wade on the floor, because they're when you don't have him on the floor, you're going to have somebody a lot crummier on the floor, for one. They don't have a lot of great shooters, so like they weren't spacing it as well. And Barry needs space, right? He needs driving lanes. And like he hits that game winner against Iowa State. The lane's probably not open for him to do that if, like, Dean Wade's not on the floor. Like, even though Dean Wade only scored, I think, one bucket in that Iowa State game, just the fact that he was able to space the floor for Barry to have more room to operate was huge. So
he has gravity. No one else on that team has gravity.
Exactly, exactly. And they've always guarded well. You know, their defensive numbers all season have been good. So it's not like their defense is suddenly playing great. Like, but Dean helps their defense too, because he's a pretty good defender. Like, he's probably an underrated defender just because he can get out and move his feet a little bit, and he's smart and you know, knows their stuff, knows what he's doing on both ends. Like, Dean Wade's just a really, really smart veteran basketball player who's pretty darn skilled. So taking your best player off was obviously hurting them. And now that he's back, they're kind of getting back to the team that everybody thought they would be. And it makes it so everybody else's role can kind of go back to being their role. You know, without him, Barry Brown's almost got to take like 30 shots a game, something stupid, you know, and he maybe necessarily doesn't have to be as high usage when Dean's out there. So, I think K-State's got a really nice team. The pieces fit together well when Wade's out there, but if he's not out there, then, you know, they kind of struggle a little bit. Their final four run, or not final, their Elite Eight run last year was just kind of on grit and, you know, catching some teams on some off nights and their defense having a big part of it and Barry Brown going a little nuts, but
getting UMBC instead of Virginia.
For them to win over a long haul of a season, like they got to have Dean Wade.
So what is your, like, are they the second best team when they're playing like this? And let's say that there's not, you know, enough to win at Iowa State every single night, but to the point where they are more this team than the team that they were, like, maybe at Marquette, or the team that lost by 20 to Texas at home. Is this the second best team in the Big 12 at this point? Because I think that's what the biggest question is. Who's the second best team in that league?
Who's the best?
Look, Kansas is going to win that league until they don't win that league. And I will not speak of it as anything else until that doesn't happen. Because every single time
– I went there.
Every single time we have that conversation – like, look, I think that Texas Tech is really, really good and that they're good enough to win the Big 12. I think that last year, Texas Tech, if Keenan Evans doesn't break his toe, I think that Texas Tech wins the Big 12 last year. I still think that this Iowa State team, with the way that they play, the shooters that they have, the playmakers that they have, as versatile as they are, the fact that they actually defend, when Cam Lard is healthy, I think that this Iowa State team is good enough to win the Big 12 this season. But Kansas is going to win it. Something is going to happen, and Kansas is just going to win it. So until that doesn't happen, like I refuse to accept it as a possibility, because I've made that prediction like three times before, and every single time I end up looking like an idiot. And I've looked like an idiot enough in my life, CJ. I don't need the help of Kansas.
I'm gonna take the turn. I'm taking it from you this year. Look like the idiot. You know, but Silvio's probably going to come back, look like Sean Kemp, and then they go win it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to end up happening out of nowhere.
out of nowhere. I mean, this Ochai has been out of nowhere. Like, it's kind of made me reevaluate things. Even though, like, he's not going to ever play a huge, huge role, but he just helps him a lot, just giving him, you know, him playing those minutes instead of, like, Charlie Moore playing those minutes, like, is huge. I think it's honestly, like, I don't know how it's going to play out, but I think Kansas State, Iowa State, and Texas Tech, it's between those four. And I just think it's going to be a jumbled mess at the end, and it could be one of those years where two teams share it. Here would be my, you know, I wrote a couple of weeks ago that I think whenever Kansas beat or lost Iowa State, I said I thought Iowa State had the best talent in the league, and I still think that. Now I think Cam Lard is important to them because he gives them some rim protector and a rim protector. That's a good word, rim protector and a rim roller. You know, can give them a guy that can attack the rim out of the pick and roll and kind of help their spread game. I think he's an important piece to that. And so, you know, if they get him back, I think that's really important when and if they get him back and he kind of starts to return. I thought he was starting to come back to playing, looking more like himself from last year, didn't you?
Yeah, he was. He was definitely getting back there. He was a little bit more athletic. And I believe he was, even though he didn't play last night, that they won at Texas Tech. I believe he was available. He was available to go, but he just didn't end up getting used.
But we don't know that, like, how's he going to be the rest of the year? Even though he plays, maybe he won't be the same guy. But, okay, let's assume he plays. They're going to be in there. Here's my reasoning for why – if Texas Tech wins the league, here's the reason why I think they will. The Big 12 is not a good shooting league. Like, it's just not. Usually it is. Usually, you know, you've had Kansas in these recent years. You've had Iowa State always shoots the heck out of it. Iowa State's probably the best shooting team in the league. And what are they shooting from three? I can look at it real quick. They're shooting 35-6 from three. So solid, but not great. When that's your best shooting team in the league, I think it is really, really conducive to Texas Tech having a pretty good conference record because they basically take away the paint. They make you play in crowds inside the three-point line, and they'll give you threes. You got to be able to make threes to beat them. I don't know if there's enough teams in this league that can make threes to beat them. So there's going to be a couple nights where a couple teams get hot and beat them. But over the long haul, like, that's a really good strategy with this particular league. And the defense, you know, is already elite, but it's going to be look probably even more elite because the league lacks shooting. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And just to be clear, TCU is the best 3-point shooting team in the league, but TCU is also without Jalen Fisher.
Just lost one of those players.
Yeah, without Jalen Fisher, they are they're not at this point a part of that conversation. As far as I am concerned, the thing
I'd actually say I think Iowa State's a better shooting team than TCU. I know TCU's got like a tick better, but Iowa State takes more threes. And I think over the long haul, Iowa State will be the better shooting team. But, you know, that's nitpicking.
Fair enough. So with Iowa State and with Texas Tech, the win by last night, Iowa State went into Texas Tech. They were up by 10 for most of that game. And I think they ended up winning by like 4 points. What do you chalk that up to? Is that just Iowa State caught them on a good day? Is that the fact that Iowa State has the playmakers and the shooters to be able to break down that defense? Did you end up watching that game today? Like,
I watched it last night.
What is your take on how that game played out? And I guess, where do you think, cause it kind of, that's like, that is exactly what throws this entire ordeal into a mess, right? Like, Iowa State beats Kansas at home. They lose at home to Kansas State. Then they go into Texas Tech and they win that game. And it's things like that that throw the whole conference for a loop and those conference rankings for a loop. So where do you stand on what happened in that game and why Iowa State was able to win it?
All right. So Iowa State ended up scoring a hair less than a point per possession. So it wasn't like they had a great offensive night, but I thought they ran really good offense. And I think the way to play Texas Tech is you've got to try to spread them out. And, you know, because if you run stuff in tight, like, they're going to make you play in a crowd. Like, you have to have great floor spacing against them. And you have to have shooters that they respect. And I think they respect Iowa State shooters. And so they had to extend a little bit more than they'd like to. And Iowa State actually had driving lanes. And Iowa State did move the ball great. Like, you have to have great ball movement against those guys. You've got to space it. And you've got to shoot threes. And even though they didn't shoot threes great, they at least shot him, and it opened some other things up for them, and they ended up shooting the ball pretty well inside the paint. So I thought it was a good strategy against Iowa State. But the thing is, like, how many teams in the Big 12 can really play that way? Like, so TCU might be a team that could give Texas Tech a little bit of problem. But without Jalen Fisher and having that secondary ball handler, like, I think that really hurts them. You know, maybe Texas every once in a while can have a good shooting night, and they like to run that against Kansas, they just ran ball screen, roll, replace over and over again. And, you know, when they're hitting shots, maybe they could beat them. But there's not a lot of teams that I think could beat that defense. K-State, if Dean Wade has a great night. So just over the long haul, I think Texas Tech is going to win a lot of games because not many people are going to score against them. But to kind of answer your question, I thought Iowa State had a great strategy. While they didn't shoot it great, the strategy helped them. They got enough stops. And, you know, it just comes down to, like, is Jarrett Culver going to go for 35 or is it going to go for 20? And he only went for – I don't even know what he ended up with. He played great, but he left a couple buckets on the table. And, you know, Texas Tech, not a great scoring team, but Culver can carry him a lot of nights. He had 20 last night.
Yeah, he had 20, and he actually probably should have had 30. He missed 5 free throws, and I at least off the top of my head, three layups at the rim that he normally finishes. Like, part of the so I have him, like, I just released a mock draft today, and I have him number 6, I want to say, definitely in the top 7. And I have him that high because in part, like, one, he's probably 6'7 now. He's listed at 6'5, but he's definitely grown.
He's tall.
He's probably 6'7. He's definitely put on some weight and some muscle too, and he's stronger. He can operate in ball screens. If you play in that defense, you have to at least be an adequate defender. I don't think he is a great individual defender. Like, I don't think he's ever going to be like PJ Tucker or anything like that. But I think that when you play in that system, Chris Beard is going to teach you to be a good enough defender where you're not going to be a liability, right? He can knock down threes. You put all that together and it makes sense. But one of the things that's really ideal about him is he can get to the rim and he can finish through contact, despite the fact that he's not exactly a great vertical leaper. He's not the best athlete. He doesn't have the longest arms, but he's strong enough to finish, to absorb contact and finish through it. And last night, he did not do that. He missed at least 3 layups in the second half, and he missed 5 free throws for the game. And if those go down, like, we're talking about something very, very different. Because the way that Texas – like, they don't blow people out. What they do is they kind
of –
They wear you down. They play close games, and they just trust that Jarrett Culver and on the nights when he's getting doubled or not doing it, Matt Mooney are going to be able to make the plays in the half court. Sometimes it's Davide Moretti. They just trust that they're going to make big plays in clutch moments. And last night it was Iowa State that made the big plays. It was, I want to say it was Nick Weiler-Babb hit a late jumper, and then there was a turnover that led to a fast break and an alley-oop for Lindell Wigginton that kind of put the game away. So it kind of played exactly the way that you would expect a Texas Tech game to play. It just, they didn't, Jarrett Culver was, like, just good. He wasn't unbelievable. And when he's not unbelievable and Matt Mooney and Davide Moretti aren't there to kind of step up and pick up the slack a little bit, this is what happens.
Yeah. And, but most nights their defense is just going to wear you down. And, you know,
Right.
Iowa State late in that game, they kind of got out of what they were doing,
yes,
you know, and they tensed up a little bit, and they wear you down. They are so mentally tough. And, there's something. What do you think of, so kind of off topic a little bit here, and I'm not an NBA draft guy, and I don't like doing that kind of stuff that much. I'd much rather prefer talking about these guys as college players and their game. But somebody mentioned to me, I was talking to him about Culver, and you know, you even said it just a minute ago. They didn't think he was a great athlete, and that's why they thought, you know, he could be a good pro, but you know, I don't think he's going to be all worldly, but I think he might be one of those guys that you underestimate his athleticism because he's so damn smooth. And like I was watching last night, like, he looked pretty athletic getting around those guys last night. Like, he was getting to the spots. He just wasn't finishing. But I don't think it was an athleticism that was making him not finish. So what do you think of him? I've been so impressed. Like, I thought he was going to be a nice player this year, but I didn't, you know, this off the bounce stuff that he was doing now. He was not. You didn't see barely any of that last year. And, you know, he'd be their best player even if Zaire Smith came back, I think. He's been unbelievable.
Yeah, I thought he was going to fill in the Zaire Smith role this season, and he hasn't. He's been doing what they had Keenan Evans doing last year. Like, he is their go-to guy.
They put him better at it than Keenan. Yeah. Like, Keenan was awesome, and he's even better at it.
Yeah, they put him in ball screens. They give him the ball late clock, and they just kind of ask him to break somebody down and make a play and find somebody. And he's a really good passer. And look, if you're going to be a wing in the NBA, you have to be a very, very, very good athlete. When I say he's not a great athlete, I'm saying, like, he's not Zaire Smith. And he's not.
Defensively, it shows up maybe a little bit more, but offensively, he looks pretty smooth getting around people.
He does. So my take is he's one of, like, the safer picks in this draft. Like, you take him, and you know he's just going to be somebody that plays the wing in the NBA for, like, a decade, right? Like, I don't think that we're ever going to talk about him as somebody that's making an all-star game, and we're probably not going to be talking about him as somebody that's averaging 20 points a game. But he's just going to be one of these guys that floats around and is a starter on good NBA teams and a starter on playoff teams for, like, the next 10 or 12 years. And
if he becomes a really, really good shooter, I wouldn't rule it out. Like, I don't know that he's a great shooter. He's shooting almost 38 from three, I think. If he became a really great shooter, I could see him being a pretty damn good NBA player. Like, yeah, he's going to be solid, but I could see him being a guy that you know, he'd be one of those guys that I'd want in this draft, because it's not a great draft, I don't think. But I was kind of curious to get your take, because I think maybe he's one of those guys that we underestimate his athleticism a little bit because he's so smooth.
Yeah, no, and that's probably fair. I just think that he is – you know what you're getting with him. Like, part of it is – so somebody like a Kevin Porter, right? Like, his floor is as a guy that is out of the NBA before his rookie contract is up, right? Like, if he doesn't, sure, there's plenty of red flags with him in terms of, you know, did he act like, why did it take him 6 weeks to get back from a thigh bruise? Why did he just get suspended from USC and Andy Enfield, who is, like, notoriously not a guy that is going to be suspending all that many people? Does his jump shot actually work? Like, his floor is very, very low. But I think that Kevin Porter's ceiling is also as the best scorer in this draft. I would not be surprised to look up in 6 years and see him being a guy that averages, like, 22, 23, 24 points per game in the NBA. Because when you have his size, his build, his athleticism, and his ability to create space off the bounce, like, that is the prototype for what you're looking for at the NBA. But when you draft him, you know that you have this wide range. Like, maybe there's a 10% chance that he hits his ceiling, and maybe there's a 30% chance that he hit his floor, and you're just kind of, like, guessing, like, where it's going to end up being. And you don't know what you're going to get. With Jarrett Culver, I think you know you're going to get a guy that can start in the NBA. But I think you also know you're going to get a guy that is not going to be much more than, like, an above-average starter in the NBA. Like, if he ends up for his career averaging, like, 12 points, 4 assists, and shoots 38% from three, and he ends up being, like, the number 8 pick, like, you got plenty of value from that pick. But you're just not getting somebody that – with the chance it could end up being a franchise-changing talent. And when you're drafting in the top 10, for the most part, you're going to be a team that needs to find somebody that is a franchise-changing talent. And so that's why I think he might end up dropping a little bit lower than maybe he should go, just because there's no chance of him – like, you're not picking him and expecting to get Russell Westbrook. You know what I mean? You're picking him, and you know what you're going to get. So I think that's why he might drop a little bit when you have the bad NBA teams that are drafting. Does that make sense?
A little bit.
All right, last thing, Jalen Fisher, what does that loss mean for TCU, and where do you see them going moving forward?
I just think they're going to be a nice, solid team in the Big 12. That really hurts them, just because they don't have enough dudes. Like, you know, I saw them against Kansas, what was it, last week, and they just don't have enough talent on the floor, I don't think, without him. I was kind of surprised. You know, they're not as good a passing team as Jamie Dixon teams usually are. Alex Robinson's an incredible passer, but other than that, like, you just got to have another guy that can kind of make plays, and you can't put everything on one guy, right? And so I think it just puts even more on Alex Robinson's plate. Because I think Fisher had understood his role maybe a little bit better this year. Like, last year, maybe when he went out, it helped him a little bit, because it was like, okay, now it's Alex's show. But I think he understood it was Alex's show this year. It's Alex's show this year, and he could kind of play off of him a little bit more. And so when you take that out, it just really, really lowers their ceiling. They're a bubble-ish team probably all year, I think.
Yeah, they're probably close to it. It's just weird. Like, I'm guessing that Jalen Fisher probably wanted to transfer because, one, If he doesn't play another game, he gets a medical redshirt, and he has 2 years of eligibility. And two, anywhere he goes, he'll actually be able to be the point guard instead of the secondary ball handler. And I'm sure that probably
Lass is a senior, so he might be able to take it over next year.
Fair enough, but you still get the 2 years of eligibility if you don't play again this season and you go somewhere else. But what's interesting is that he is the third or fourth player to transfer out of TCU this year. Like, that's why they don't have any depth. Because you had a Locke transferred out, right? Caden Archie transferred out. And now Jalen Fisher transferred out. Now you're looking at a situation where you have, what, like 7, 8 scholarship players left?
Yeah, it's rough.
It's hard out there for Jamie Dixon. That's probably why he's not going to get UCLA. I went there.
Yeah. Maybe so. He might be running to it. Come on, guys. Let me have this. So, I don't know. The game they played against Kansas, it was kind of surprising. That Kevin Samuel kid was killing Dedrick Lawson. They just kind of went away from him in the second half. And they've got some okay pieces, but I just really think it hurts them not having that guy. So
yeah,
I think they were solidly into the tournament if he would have stayed healthy and stuck around. But now I think they're just a team that probably hangs around on the bubble all year.
Probably fair. Well, listen, CJ, I've kept you for long enough, man. I appreciate the time. Anybody that's still listening, you can find CJ on Twitter at CJ Moore Hoops. My man, I appreciate the time.
All right, see you.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.